Good day and welcome to all our attendees for today's teleclass, and also welcome to December. It's hard to believe the year has gone by as quickly as it has. I'm Lynn Seeholster from CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'll be serving as the guest host for today's teleclass. Before I introduce today's speaker, on behalf of all our attendees and visitors to the Weber Teleclass Archives, I want to thank Dr. Saeed Sattar of the University of Ottawa and Paul Weber for their vision and commitment to distance learning by establishing this teleclass opportunity for all these many years. Having said that, it is my distinct honor and privilege to introduce today's speaker, Andy Streifel. He is a good friend and colleague. Andy is a public health specialist in the Department of Environmental Health and Safety at the University of Minnesota. When we need answers to our questions about the indoor environment in our healthcare settings, Andy is the go-to guy. He's generous with his time and knowledge. He's helped many, many hospitals throughout the U.S. and abroad to solve problems during outbreaks and other adverse events related to the indoor environment, air and water and so forth. So today, his topic is going to be Trust But Verify, Design, Build, and Validation for Infection Control Acceptance. And with that, I present Andy Streifel.
Thank you so much, Lynn and Paul, for providing this venue for me to be able to talk to you about the things that are near and dear to me. So I really, really appreciate that. As you can see from this slide, we're looking at my domain, a variety of buildings, somewhere around 4 to 5 million square feet of an academic health center, and one which has all varieties of mechanical systems and spaces that have been built since 1924 till 1986. So we have a great deal of variety, and with that becomes opportunity for something that isn't quite right. So again, it's that vigilance, it's that trusting, but we want to verify. May I add, too, that if you wish to contact me or ask me questions, my email is at the bottom. It's much better than trying to call me. And so we'll move on here and try and get done here in the next 60 minutes. As we look at ventilation management in healthcare, we have to think about what controls that. And as our first standard started to develop after the Hill-Burton Act in 1947 here in the United States, we began making recommendations to codify that environment. And that means we really needed to control a comfort and temperature and relative humidity that has often been delegated to the American Society for Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning and Engineers, that ASHRAE component that helped us manage comfort. It also is very instrumental in developing the controls for smoke and fire, which also falls in the hands of the code associated with the National Fire Protection Agency. And then, of course, we've got our building codes, the electrical, the plumbing, and the uniform, as well as the international building codes that dictate how we put our buildings together. And we have to incorporate with all of those codes, those infectious disease management principles on the airborne spread of diseases, which include TB, measles, chickenpox, aspergillosis. And there we have a variety with of agencies or groups, American Institute of Architects, now the Facilities Guidelines Institute, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and of course ASHRAE, are all important for or developing the concepts and guidelines. As we look at the third slide, we want to make sure we understand infection control airflow management. And that pretty much means that we manage the supply versus the exhaust return air volumes to create the concept of clean to dirty, which we often call positive or negative pressure rooms. When we have greater exhaust, again, trying to isolate that infectious disease, we want to have more going out of the room than coming in to create an inward flow, or as we call it, negative. The greater supply, we have overabundance of supply air going to that space, which creates an excess, which again can be demonstrated by airflow out when we try to protect the patient. And we do this with pressure. I often say that pressure is infection control, infection prevention, because that's how we control those airborne spread aerosols. And it first became really evident in with the American Institute of Architects in the 90s and with the establishment of pressure, that pressure management aspect, which we'll talk a lot about in this program, is really what we're looking for. And of course, that airflow velocity that's consistent is essential. So why do we validate on that? Next slide, we want to really confirm existing conditions. If we built it right, it should be still in that condition. But we have to make sure that we have all the other things in place, which include, again, with the sequence of controls that are built into our buildings, that comfort and moisture management in the form of humidity control are maintained. And we have sensors to do that. Fire management, likewise, is another consideration. That is what we call the BOSS code, B-O-S-S. That is to say that it really dictates how we operate our H-class building, which is occupied 24/7. It's an essential part of life safety, and, of course, it's one that's very important in managing our buildings. And, of course, if we think of infection control and fire management, we can begin to start thinking about how we can incorporate these kinds of parameters that are important for both in managing the surge, managing construction, and the airborne spread infectious diseases. But first, we need to think about that performance, the performance of the utility safety management tools that we build into our buildings to manage not only the patient, but also to protect the employee and visitors. So graciously, Lynn, as part of her work plan back in the early 2000, quite a while actually, back in those days, I remember consultation with her on this project of putting together the environmental infection control guidelines, which speak to a variety of our microorganisms, the fungi, the bacteria, and the virus, and which of those are truly airborne spread, those which are somewhat atypical, and those that are sometimes transmitted. But regardless, the fact is they come out of our mouths in the form of droplets. Those droplets then float when the patient is infectious, and we control them, as you can see on the slide. Within my institution, we used to cover the supply ducts in order to create the negative pressure, which is truly a disservice to the patient because we took away the cooling and truly an irritation to the employee, which had to wear PPE in a very hot environment. The important point to remember is that diseases are spread via the air. They can come to the patient, and on the next slide where we have schematics from the CDC guidelines on the types of rooms that we try to manage, we have a depressurized condition and a pressurized condition. And the negative pressure, again, these pressures and airflows all need to be validated, and we find those validation figures in the document, again, the June 6th Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report, Environmental Infection Control, in Table 6, the engineering specifications for positive and negative pressure rooms. Those rooms then are identified as having a pressure relationship either going into or out of. It has an air change rate. It has a filtration requirement. It has an ideal pressure management setting. And, of course, these are the infection control commissioning guidelines that we want to verify and re-verify in the life and usage of that particular space within a hospital. We do that, again, when we're dealing with environmental risk factors for TB transmission, and those are well listed, again, in the more recent Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report guideline on TB transmission. And certainly we know that inadequate cleaning, recirculation of air, and inadequate local general ventilation, and a lack of proper procedures, really, and most importantly, the unrecognized patient, all contribute to that exposure, and those are the things we try to manage. So how do we do that? The next slide, which demonstrates some of the tools we utilize, from a smoke stick to a pressure gauge to the air balancing hood, are all intended to establish or at least recognized airflow direction and pressure. The only device here that really gives you a quantification of that particular airflow is that pressure gauge at the bottom. We want a number because that number tells us exactly the intensity we need to know, whereas the smoke stick shows us where the air is going in the form of aerosol control, and that balancing hood just simply sets up the airflow volumes to create the conditions so we can manage those airborne infectious diseases, which include on the next slide from patients and visitors, the VZV, varicella zoster virus, and in some instances, potentially in close proximity, respiratory syncytial virus. Again, not commonly thought of as airborne spread. But then when we think of the environmental microbes, there are a whole variety of fungi, Legionella, of course, and there are some instances where people feel that gram-negative bacteria, depending on how close they are to the source, can also be airborne spread. But needless to say, we need to control that. The next slide demonstrates again that the individual creating those droplet nuclei, and they certainly, if the patient is infectious, are generated by talking, coughing, or sneezing. And if we have the proper air change rates, we can control those droplet nuclei. And in the graphics in the chart, there is an air change rate comparison to the amount of time that those particles can be removed by 90%, 99%, or 99.9%. And it is this parameter of air change that becomes important in dilution of the contaminant in the air that we need to manage. So what we need to think about as we start to look into this information, or how we validate, is how we interpret information when we get it, objective data. What are we trying to accomplish and what should the data show? We're going to give you examples of what we want to be able to demonstrate. Baseline data. What do we mean by baseline data when we're talking about an infection control system? We want to verify that the room works the way it was intended. And that means the pressures are there, the air changes are there, and in many instances, the filtration is appropriate for the protection of the individuals, regardless if it's a patient or an employee. We also look at sampling when we have disease. But nice thing about some of this information that you will see, it helps the surgeon understand that it's not the ventilation that's causing the problem in the surgical wound infection situation that might be investigating at my institution or yours. And I certainly am getting calls on that particular issue, and we certainly have develop some of the data, which I will show you here very shortly. And that really means that we validate the control systems to maintain that baseline so that we can come back and show, hey, things haven't changed. What do you think the problem really is? The fact that you're not bundling up during surgery or something else. So again, it allows for a dialogue of conversation that might be a little more directed to solving the problem. And that is, we need to break the chain of infection if we begin to see it or prevent it in the first place. And we do that in one instance with a depressurized condition to, again, keep the pathogen in place. And the other is to deal with the source. What is the source? Is it the human? The surgeon, is it an environmental microbe because we have a water leak and have mold growing on the wall? But regardless, we need to think about source management and pressure management in an effort to deal with that. But then if we look at the next slide and we start to think about how our rooms operate, I was given Homeland Security money to go out and do a performance assessment of airborne infectious disease isolation rooms. And when we looked at the rooms I had available to me, we surveyed 678 of those rooms, and most of those rooms did not meet the criteria, which will show up on the next slide. Most importantly, there were inadequate pressures in a huge percentage of those rooms. The filtration was really demonstrated as not working in a huge percentage, and this is something I have seen nationwide, in these United States anyway, and often there were a lack of written plans. Now, this is 2007. We've made great strides there amongst those hospitals that we evaluated to achieve, again, in the next slide, those airborne infection room criteria, which come directly from the Facilities Guidelines Institute criteria that we design and build our hospitals. And that manual is followed by 42 states nationwide. So we found in those studies that there were a variety of performance deficiencies in those airborne infection isolation rooms. They are listed there. You can go to the article and read them. We had to sanitize this data to a certain extent because it might implicate certain institutions. But regardless, to say, when we sampled this in the mid-2000s, we did see that a lot of the rooms did not work, and we were preparing for that pandemic event. But as we go to the next slide, we look at a graphic that has on the x-axis the installed filter efficiencies versus measured efficiency, and you will see those methods demonstrated here momentarily. But what it amounts to is whatever we said we installed in some 100 and some air handling systems that were evaluated, and then when we measured it with a particle counter, we found that even if we gave that air handling system some leeway, saying that, okay, we'll accept an 80% reduction of the 0.5 micron size particle, we still see a huge percentage of filtration systems that simply don't work. Looking at the next slide, the reasons might be in this particular case, in this particular Pennsylvania hospital, the filters got wet. They blew out because they weren't supported and they were made out of paper. There are many reasons why filters don't work, and in a recent situation in California, I visited a hospital where they had the best filters money could buy, 95% very expensive filters, but there was essentially no filtration because the filters did not fit the rack. Again, why spend the money for $20,000 for a filter system when we don't know if it works? So we need to deal with those kinds of validation issues, and we'll talk about that momentarily. The next slide is a study of fungal prevalence in a university hospital, mine. We've been sampling in this institution since 1958. We'll see some of that data momentarily, but what it is, what I'm trying to say is that we are sampling in this study. In table one, we see that we're sampling filtration systems. We want to demonstrate that the filters work. That is an essential criteria. And then if we have the proper pressure to keep organisms away or in and the proper air changes, we can purge those from that environment, again, to keep it safe. So our study really set out to evaluate that environment. And in the table two colony-forming units per cubic meter sampled over 10 years, the red lines are your HEPA-filtered 99.97, then patient care areas. And again, this is a summarization of the data. There's a lot more data in the article, but for the purposes of these presentations, this will present my concepts, which I hope that you all grasp. And that pretty much means that if you look at a comparison of outdoor fungi to indoor fungi in the HEPA-filtered environment, your averages are the lowest. That's a very good thing because what we like to say in identifying an interpretation method, that the rank order says we're dealing with a clean, cleaner, or cleanest environment. And this, of course, then being the cleanest environment, our HEPA-filtered environment, and we do not throw out the outliers at either incubation temperature 25°C or 35°C, 37°C, because if you see those large numbers, and regardless where you're going to look in the hospital, represent a phenomenon. And that phenomenon is often hard to explain, but it is a cloud of spores that is floating around in the building. And it's because they've been released. We'd like to control those, but often we don't know when they happen. So we rely on that ventilation in those unknown conditions to purge the environment. And that is the solution to pollution, and that is good old dilution. And that we need to be able to move the air. And as you can see, that range is rather high, not only indoors but also outdoors, because it's a dynamic environment. It's very encouraging to see the range go from zero to a large number and a median being where it is. So those events are somewhat rare. And I make that point because in the next slide, we think about a burst. What is a burst? And that burst can come from my mouth as I sneeze, or it can come from a disturbance of an environmental source. And so what we have done is sampled in this hospital 1,243 times over a 10-year period. And during all of those samples, we found 48 situations where we had a burst. That burst was 3 standard deviations above the mean and represents an event. We often found those after the fact, again, a penny short and a day late. So what good is it to sample when we find out when it's too late? Our efforts really need to be focused on validation of barriers, validation of rooms, validation of procedures, because as we look at the next slide, we can see at my institution, we've made great strides in 20-year increments. The biggest stride over the last 20 years between 82 and 2002, simply because we bought a hospital, built a hospital that where we could control the air exchanges, the pressure differentials, the airflow direction, and good particle management with procedural practice. Very important principles, again, for preventing some of the most difficult diseases, infectious diseases, to control. So as the next slide comes out, we talk about commissioning issues, the need to validate, the need to demonstrate. And we can do that real time with particle counters and less advantageous, I would say, with some kind of air sampler. We're certainly looking at air sampling and particle counting in a current study we're doing now to see if we can correlate particle sizes in highly filtered environments with the number of microbes there. And if you're highly filtered, we are going to assume that if you've got low particle counts, there are very few microbes in the air, except under those short-term exposure conditions, and those are handled with a large volume of air being moved through that space. But we still use these tools to validate not only the conditions in the room, the existing conditions, but also the performance of our filters. And when we look at the filtration efficacy slide, we see that we have a demonstration, a graphic that comes from a NIOSH document that on the x-axis shows particle size versus the fractional collection efficiency, or the efficiency of the filter. If you multiply that, those numbers by 100, you get the percent efficiency. And we can see that somewhere in the middle, around 0.3 microns, for some physical reason, that particle is difficult to capture. But on either end, with the larger particles, interception and impaction are removed. The larger particles on those fibers, and on the smaller particles, those less than a micron in size, a tenth of a micron, it's the diffusion and electrostatic attraction that removes the particle. So we know filters work. And as I stated, the problem isn't so much the filters themselves, but it is the housing. In a study we did many years ago, I used this old slide with pictures of the equipment that we used to study this. We found that we have to consider how many nines you need to show that the filters work. We say 2 nines. And as you can see, from this study, that 99% of incoming fungi were removed from the filtration system that we had set up. And this is generally true in hospital systems that are properly installed. However, the next slide shows the reality check. This Chicagoland hospital looked out inside the bank, and it looked absolutely perfect. Every bag was in place. But when I stuck my particle counter through the wall, in the air balance holes and took a reading, I found that I only was seeing 60 to 70% reduction. And when we opened up that particular fan system and peeked in the lower corner, we saw ripped out filters. Now, I see this all over the place, not so much with bag filters, but with cartridge filters or whatever type of filter. They just simply don't fit the rack, or they're not properly installed, or in this case, they have worn out. Bag filters do that for a variety of reasons. There is a system, the next slide shows, which you can sample before and after a filter system, and you can see with a particle counter, utilizing the 0.5 micron size particle, what type of filtration efficacy you see across that particular filter bank. And that is a very useful tool. The next slide shows a sample log, an example of what we saw again in a Pennsylvania hospital, where we see 12,000 particles before the filter versus 40 particles after. Again, a very nice demonstration of how well a filter can work, and many of these filters do work like this if the care is taken to get them properly sealed in place. The next slide shows how we can interpret that. This is from a manual that we wrote on temporary negative pressure isolation. I believe that's available through Paul's website. We presented on this some year or so ago, and we'll show you a slide here very shortly where you can obtain this. It's a public domain. It tells you how to set up containment systems as well as utilize a particle counter and a pressure gauge to interpret the guidelines within an environment. So this just essentially says that you get some percentage reduction for a certain percentage efficient filter. So this is what we want to see for a baseline. We want to see that rate of reduction rather than a number. If we have 100,000 particles outside, you should see 90% reduction, or 10,000 particles inside. So it's important to do that. I had one ICP infection control preventionist call me saying she shut down a surgery, and I said, why? And he said, because the particle counts were over 200,000 inside the surgical suite. I said, what were they outside? Oh, there was a fire outside, and we had well over 2 million particles. So again, the filters were working properly, and did she really need to shut that down? Well, you know, it's one of those things that you need to be able to interpret the data once you get it. Let's go to another topic. As we begin to switch to talk about the room pressures themselves and how we manage them, we did some studies some years ago on our rooms, and we began to really realize that when you open and close doors, you see little puffs of air that move about the building, and that's what the depiction is with the door swing. Now, that's not much air. It's not much air at all. That's a tiny infinitesimal amount, but it showed us the leakage in those rooms. And so when we go to the next slide, we see that there's a lot of potential for leakage. And when the CDC established a leakage rate of a half a square foot per room, and all of that is right around those windows, the lighting, the ceilings, and a variety of places where air can come into a room. And that is a big problem when we look at our negative pressure rooms, where the supply air is circumvented by the leakage area, which gives us less control. And how does that happen? The next slide shows holes in the walls and holes in the ceilings. And this stuff happens. This is real. We find leaks all over the place in hospitals, especially the older buildings that haven't been maintained through the years, keeping up with fire code. And certainly when you have holes in the ceiling like the one in the lower right, that certainly brought odors up into some areas within our hospital and caused a great deal of concern because it didn't smell very good. So certainly we have these conditions, and the next slide shows what we did to try and understand what we were doing in our modern hospital. We took a duct blaster, and we wanted to test the integrity of a room. I sit on the ASHRAE 170 standards committee that checks over or watches over the maintenance of ventilation for hospitals. And what we tried to do is define a leak-proof room or a sealed room. Now, there is a standard that's out there for a weatherized house. at 2.5 square inches of leakage per 100 square feet of surface area. But that is a hard thing to apply to a hospital. And when we tested our rooms, we found that our airborne infection isolation rooms had 22 square inches of leakage, whereas our bone marrow transplant rooms only had 3 square inches of leakage when they were tested by these methods. So we were very confused as to how this could be, and when we began to look at it, we really started to find all of those leakage areas in the room. So as we begin to think about how we're going to seal a room, the next slide shows how we've gone up and caulked the sound insulation that sits on the demising walls, or walls that separate rooms rather than corridors or the outside. So the side walls, if you will, in a hospital room have points at the very top close to the slab that need to be sealed. We cannot use our ceiling anymore as a sealing point, S-E-A-L, a ceiling point, because we're putting so many lifts in our rooms, the camber does not allow us to seal that ceiling to give us the pressure management. We've even gone so far as to seal all of the electrical, all of the other points of penetration around the plumbing fixtures and so on within a room, because all of these combined allow the room to leak. And when we're pulling, exhausting that room, that is a point that we cannot tolerate, because we can't validate the room to have the sufficient pressure to control. So as we're building a new hospital, we brought in specialists that manage weatherization of homes. Gary Nelson, the one you see with a gauge in his hand, taught us how to deal with blower doors, which allows us to depressurize or pressurize a space. And in the raw form, before we started to build the rooms themselves, the structure was up. We see if someone on the right looking through some insulation, and that individual, in fact, is learning how to seal the room. It's a tradesman, and the graphic, computer graphic below was that feedback system that we were able to demonstrate that if we could fix the leakage in the room, we made the room more airtight. And we have a leakage rate now on our rooms in our new hospital of 1/10 of a cubic foot per minute per square foot. Now, that's somewhat esoteric for all of you, but it's very important for that ventilation design engineer, because that means if we keep that room tight, they will hit the numbers and we will commission that space correctly for infection control reasons. Because as we look at the next slide, there are lots of reasons for ventilation deficiencies. This is a reality. Our sensors plug. We certainly can get plug filters, coils, we can get duct leakage, and so our standards are getting better and better every day to be able to manage these so that we can see what happens in the next slide, as the case was in an LA hospital where the duct wasn't put together right, there's air spillage. Some of that caused condensation, as you can see from the rust, mold growth, and a subsequent disease as the mechanics went in to fix a hot room and ended up releasing fungal spores. Likewise, on the other slide, we have a situation at my institution where we had put a curtain rod over an exhaust vent in an isolation room, plus the room had 10,000 holes in the ceiling. We could not hold pressure because of plug ducts and holey ceilings, again, because we were naive into the construction design of those rooms back in those days. And likewise, in the next slide, we have to realize that our buildings aged as soon as we turned the air handling systems on, and it's the lint that prevents the airflow, the lint that keeps the contamination in the environment, either to smell if it stinks, or if it's a particle, it doesn't get removed from that environment. So again, the validation of the environment requires that we keep especially the exhaust ducts clean so that we can move air. And the reason why we need to move air in the next side is to be able to manage the particle, to be able to manage the fume or particle. In this case, it's infectious disease particle. And we use an age of air concept that essentially says that when a particle enters a space, how long does it take to get out? and we can study this particular concept, and we do that most readily in operating rooms because the next slide shows the variety of ventilation patterns that we can put into operating rooms. But needless to say, what we really want to do is move air to demonstrate in a downward flow in the most recent interpretation of how airflow should be in an operating room environment, and that is pretty much an airflow from the top to the bottom at a certain speed over the surgical site, which runs roughly around 30 to 35 linear feet per minute. And with that kind of airflow, in even recent information that I've obtained in a surgical wound infection study we're doing now at a local hospital, we're able to show that that ventilation rate is very effective at keeping things away in the form of a video clip, which I believe I will send to Paul for you to review as we see a downward flow, which is represented by this graphic, and kept that smoke from reaching the surgical site because of the type of airflow that was there. Our purpose in many instances to control those sources, and often we get complaints about laser plume, electrocautery plume, or some kind of aerosol that's generated, and certainly we do have opportunities to generate those aerosols, so we need to be able to demonstrate control. The next slide shows that kind of control. When we have an aerosol that's in a high-volume room and we generate it either by turning on an electrocautery device or something artificial, which I will show you in the next couple slides, we can generate a curve that looks like this. There's a spike, and then it drops. This shows while we generate the aerosol, we also control it. And we can generate this, demonstrate how well a ventilation system works, because in operating rooms, in surgical wound infection situations that I've looked at, the next slide shows the potentials for messing that ventilation up. I have seen hospitals with refrigerators in front of their exhaust extractors in the rooms. We've seen electrophysiology catheters blocking, and it really, really affects airflow. Common sense evaluations are the best. You go in, you see it. If it's blocked, move it. I took a bunch of pictures this last weekend of a similar situation because it affects the ability of the air to dilute the contaminants that might be there. We can study this, and it's a very fascinating thing we've done over the last year or so. In the next slide, we can bring in carbon dioxide generators. Again, this is beverage gas. We can generate with this loop, this circle, an aerosol of gas, which behaves very similarly to the particles. And then we can measure the efficacy of removal utilizing the instruments on the right, which are carbon dioxide monitors, and is very effective at demonstrating how well a space works, regardless if it's an operating room, an airborne infection isolation room, or a bone marrow transplant protective environment. And what's tended to do in the next slide is to show these kinds of spikes disappearing. We've got similar spikes with the carbon dioxide, but this particular spike occurred during a hip resection where the surgeons were all bent out of shape, that the ventilation was bad, and they quickly muted that that concept by this demonstration. While the numbers were not particularly high by anything I've ever seen in hospitals, this was very effective in demonstrating control. You generate when you're cutting with the electrocautery, but it rapidly disappears, and it doesn't persist. So it's, again, what we want to show, and it, again, allows us to talk about the topic of greatest concern in surgical wound infections the majority of the time, and that is proper technique rather than ventilation. And it's gratifying to see in the next slide, in which comes from a bone marrow transplant room, that when we administer various kinds of medicated aerosols, albuterol is the larger, smaller spikes, and the ribavirin is that more consistent upward stroke, that we can control the environment. We need to be careful when we use these drugs. It's gratifying to see that we can purge the environment once we stop administering the drug in the case of ribavirin and albuterol. But again, it's that control. And this is the same kind of control we would expect if mom came into the room, brushed her sweater, knocked a few spores off, and they quickly disappeared. It's that validation of airflow, that validation of pressure that really becomes important. And the particle counter is part of that process. So certainly that particle counter is a comparison device, regardless if we're trying to show that reduction before and after, like we just showed you, or perhaps even showing the difference between outside and inside across a filter bank. We need to see a difference. We need to see a comparison. And in some instances during our construction, we've even incorporated stop work guidance that goes along with constructions in the larger size particles, which, again, do not have time to speak to here today. Local controls are important when sampling. Knowing your aerosol, knowing what it is, again, should prevent you from getting all bent out of shape. For example, if you're in an electrocautery case, you know it's smoke. It's not an infectious agent. So, again, it's understanding what that particular aerosol is, it becomes important. And we want to make sure that we have our lowest levels in the areas with the best ventilation, but we have to be careful when we use a particle counter in any kind of negative pressure environment, because that tends to pull particles which might be higher, and that's why they are higher, because they're pulled in from potentially unfiltered spaces, especially if the room is not well sealed. So again, we want to make a comparison with particle counters, and we should see significant reductions with the type of filtration that we use in those environments. And we need to be thinking about how we set up our rooms in order to accomplish that. I don't know what some design engineers think about when they were putting the hospitals together years ago, but today we're much better at it. We're very careful about the way we deal with the ceilings, how the air is delivered in operating rooms, bone marrow transplant rooms, and even in the airborne infection isolation rooms. It's that configuration that becomes important, and it's very difficult to read how these things are put together on most schematics. That's why, from my point of view, I have to sit down with the design engineers and make them draw that ceiling for me in computational, in computer graphics like you see on this slide, but again, to validate that, in fact, we do have the airflow delivery appropriate for the type of room and the control of the particles that are there. So again, we're dealing with visual, we're dealing with objective information on how these rooms are designed, and it's all part of that air balance validation. We need to make sure the locations are appropriate, that we've got the volumes and they're validated. When we put a great big building together, in our case it's about 300,000 square feet, put a great big building, they put five huge fans in there, they got a lot of ductwork going in a lot of different directions, and when that air gets to that very end, it doesn't quite seem like it was when it was designed. Maybe they're short, maybe they got too much, which is the case. They've got to put in exhaust fans, and that all has to validate. That all has to validate, and that's not something that happens easily in the last days before we occupy the building or the space. So validating those volumes becomes a stressful thing because they're pressuring to move in and they might not be right, but for infection control, they are essential. So that room should be sealed to achieve those volumes. We need to make sure the pressures are appropriate and that the filtration is right for places like operating rooms and bone marrow transplants. And if we need to, because of particular issues, we can independently evaluate air changes per hour without bringing in a test and balance. But they do test and balance under most instances. And, of course, new studies with the age of air is pretty fascinating, and certainly I want to bring that forward in future presentations. What it amounts to is we're asking our building to be performance tested. We've identified a whole bunch of rooms where special ventilation is important. Several hospitals that I'm assisting are doing this type of spreadsheet. It's our baseline information. It's the patient care unit, the room number, the type of room. Is it patient room or protective environment? the monitoring systems, local displays or monitors of the ventilation, what type of air changes both are designed, as well as what did you get when we finally balanced it out, what's the design pressure, what's the real pressure, what's that offset, the difference between supply and exhaust. So we, again, have that information to determine the airflow direction. And we need that the room volume in order, again, to calculate those air change rates. And we're getting this all done before we occupy the building. In fact, I just finished our spreadsheet yesterday to be able to submit so that we have this information when we occupy in March. The reason being that as we look at our buildings, and often our buildings are variable air volume nowadays because of energy savings, and there'll be a big push for this, for some concessions from infection control to lower air change rates when it's not being used for infection prevention, like the airborne infection isolation rooms. And it's that tracking device that's there that will become the problem. And if you choose the wrong one, because, again, what does exhaust contain? It not only contains contamination, but it contains lint. And it's that form of lint that plugs the sensors that really screws up the way that that fan operates to manage that space. And this is, again, a major reason why we have to recontinue checking, because it can create conditions. And in one hospital in these United States, made the whole building go negative and developed mold growth in unusual places because of the untempered air that sucked into that space. We need to be able to control contaminated air, and that's why we put this document together on airborne infectious disease management. It tells us how to use portable filters, and in some instances we need to use those for construction as well as disease management. If, in fact, we do get a tuberculosis case in a critical care hospital with less than 25 beds, and the policy says you will be transported to mother hospital, and we need to contain that patient for a period of time with ductwork, duct tape, and plastic, and a portable filter. And this the particular booklet, which, again, is funded by the United States taxpayers for Homeland Security reasons, is intended, again, for you to utilize. And it shows, it tells how we can prove containment with not only visually sucking up that plastic with a portable filter, but also validating the space with a particle counter. And again, these things are part of the appendix material in that particular booklet. The next slide, again, validation. You need pressure gauges. You need to know what test locations are important, which rooms. You're actually testing the intensity of the airflow and the airflow direction consistency. The interpretation of pressure is important. We'll talk about that because pressure and velocity are very similar. We're not talking pounds per square inch. We're actually talking about an escape velocity, and that escape velocity is really what we're trying to manage. The interpretation of that, again, developing that baseline, you want to see where that air is going before the project, during the project, and then after. So often before the project, the space might be pressurized. We try to depressurize it by backing off on the supply air and exhausting it through either window exhausts or a variety of other methods. But then we need to be able to set it back to where it was. And that's, again, that validation aspect, because some of that might be important, especially if it's an oncology service where susceptibility is not as great, but yet potentially great if, in fact, that part of the building sucked instead of blowing. Again, that airflow direction, we want to maintain that clean to dirty, especially around construction sites. And here's where the whole aspect of the data pressure is important, and that is that air velocity and pressure. A hundredth of an inch or 2.5 pascals pretty much mean that you're moving somewhere around 400 linear feet per minute, or whatever that would talk about as far as meters per minute or meters per second. The ideal pressure is around 200s or 300s, between 7 and 8 pascals of water column, because, again, some folks have found that you can control environmental tobacco smoke with that kind of pressure. And again, in order to accomplish this, you need a sensitive pressure gauge They are out there. They're about $500. And certainly we wanted to buy all our hospitals here in Minnesota a pressure gauge, again, so that they can validate their airborne infection isolation rooms so that they are not deficient, that they, in fact, suck instead of blow. Pressure gauges, again, are important. We certainly use them in our surgery projects. We've had some very, very tight, if you will, sensitive construction, jackhammering in operating rooms and expecting to use them the next day. And we were able to accomplish that with, again, good contractor testing. Again, we teach our contractors to use a particle counter and how to stop a project so we do not jeopardize patient safety. The next slide, again, it goes back to the devices that we utilize, be it a particle counter, a pressure gauge, or even an air balance hood, in managing that local environment to make sure that those ventilation conditions are appropriate. Because if we stumble onto sources, regardless if it's a window source because of a flashing repair in this Wisconsin hospital on the upper left, or this Atlanta hospital where the vinyl is captured moisture and mold grew behind it, or in this Minnesota hospital where we've got an aerosol potential in a mechanical space, we have to be able to manage that ventilation to control these. These things exist in our buildings. They happen for reasons sometimes unbeknownst to us, and if we don't maintain the ventilation rates, these creatures will permeate the environment and potentially cause not only allergic reaction but also infectious disease infections in our most compromised patients. So our barrier management is important. Our barrier management can't be flimsy like the upper left. We don't want to see punctures. We do want to see a critical barrier that maintains an airflow in the appropriate direction, again, away from the patient care area, and that is important. This is essential when we have to validate our in our case, in the States, the United States Pharmacopeia 797 pharmacy manufacturing. And this is some data that I collected from our pharmacy that demonstrates very nicely the kinds of controls that we want to see in various environments, that validation, if you will. Outdoors compared to that so-called anti-space that they have in pharmacies, to the biological safety cabinet, to that so-called fill area, and what we have is here is that rank order clean to cleanest comparison that is qualitative, and it's based, again, on temperature incubation. And, again, we want to make sure that training and asepsis are more important than culturing. It's the unusual event that creates the problem most often, but that day-to-day consistency in ventilation as well as hand washing is really what makes the difference in infection prevention. It's when we have a building that we're going to accept, we really need to be able to talk to the air quality in the clinical application. Today, we spent a couple of hours speaking with a major children's hospital in these United States to set up the air quality requirements for that facility as they begin to occupy that space over the next year. We also need to think about water quality. Water quality is another topic worth discussing, but yet we don't have time in this situation, but certainly one that brings up a lot of issues given the fact that some of the water bugs are pretty resistant to our prophylactic antibiotic therapies that we provide for our patients, especially the most susceptible. Clean surfaces, again, that's visual. We want to select the right things because we have to control that environment for patient safety. And it takes an interdisciplinary team to understand all these things, again, to achieve the support, because our architects have a tendency to think it all their way and not necessarily the way that the practitioner, the ICP, when coming to patient care issues. So pressure management in healthcare is essential. It's a very important aspect that controls those particles for patient and procedure rooms. And in some instances, we need to be able to control those areas for those emerging infectious diseases if they should ever pop up. We can utilize fire and smoke management because, again, if we can control smoke, if we can do so many of those things in very specific ways and we validate it, we can manage a situation where we may have to take part of our hospital and convert it. And we will do that with building pressure. We will, again, use that pressure to manage it, but we don't want to mess with the pressure so much in a building that it causes infiltration of unfiltered, untempered air, which, again, can bring moisture and condensation to that space. We use this information or these validation methods, particularly during construction, to control the aerosol and infectious diseases. So again, what's that appropriate pressure gradient? We're looking at around 200s to 300s, between 7 and 8 pascals, to create that air velocity of somewhere around 600 feet per minute, again, which should contain all particles that should be of concern to us. With that, again, we think, go back to those particle counters, those pressure gauges, and the various components that allow us to validate, to allow us to see that the building does not change. A building is not static. It is extremely dynamic. The buildings are changing constantly. As I say, they puff and pant, and that's because those variable air volume, energy controlling systems, opening and closing doors, taking out of windows, all create conditions that need to be checked and assessed so that they don't create a problem for our most compromised patients. And those tools are available. And with that, pretty much brings to an end the presentation, pretty much on time and under budget. This is our new hospital. It's a fascinating building in the exterior. I can't believe that a piece of stainless steel can be dark blue and yellow, light yellow green at the same time. But it's really a wonder. We're proud of the building. We've done a lot to make it state of the art. And certainly we'll be looking forward to speaking to you about it in the future. So with that, Lynn, Paul, and audience, I bring to an end, and if you wish to contact me or ask me questions, email is much better than trying to call me, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Andy, for an amazing lecture. I mean, this was an enormous amount of material presented logically, clearly. It was incredible. I would like to say on behalf of Dr. Sitar and Paul Weber, we thank you for attending today's teleclass lecture, and our thanks to our speaker for today, Andy Streifel from the University of Minnesota, for an outstanding lecture. And with that, we will say goodbye for now. Thanks so much. Take care. Have a wonderful day.